Seder. We're having a special class on the evolvement of the oral tradition, and we'll start from scratch and see how far we get. So the Torah was given at Sinai. Our tradition is that when the Torah was given, it was given without the nekudos, without the vowels, but with a tradition on how to read the words in the Torah. It was given with a tradition on the tunes of the Torah. It was given with a tradition of where each pasuk begins and where each pasuk ends. You look at a Sefer Torah, you don't have that division of the Torah into psukim. You don't have the vowels written into the Torah. But our tradition is that the way we're reading it is the way it was given at Sinai. Now, aside from the written Torah, which was given, there was also an oral tradition. The importance of the oral tradition cannot be understated. It is something that has been challenged in almost every generation, including Moshe Rabbeinu's generation, where Korach and his men were willing to challenge the oral tradition. The Medrash says that Moshe said to God on that occasion, either you back me or I'm switching sides. Which was another way of saying, if you don't back me now against Korach, so then there's no point in all my work. Now we see that Moshe Rabbeinu at the beginning of his job, when God sends him to take the Jews out of Egypt, says, I don't want to be believed because of miracles. If I'm going to give them your written Torah, then there has to be clarity beyond a doubt that it's you talking. And then in the story of Korach, Moshe Rabbeinu again stands his ground. Those are two occasions where we find Moshe Rabbeinu standing and saying, God, this has to happen because I'm not willing to work it any other way, so to speak. You know, our sages do say that Moshe spoke with great vehemence on both occasions. And Moshe said, there has to be a backing of the oral tradition now with the miracle of Korach being swallowed, or else leave me out of this whole story. Because if there's going to remain room for people to come and question the way Korach did, so then what am I going to do? You know, people are going to say, I invented everything. So what's the point of this whole thing? So we have the written Torah. We have the oral Torah. What's the oral Torah? So Maimonides, in his introduction to Mishnah, breaks down the components of the oral tradition. We will not use this breakdown. We don't have that much time now, so we'll focus on certain parts of the oral tradition, even though there, obviously, read the Rambam's introduction to Mishnah, and you'll see a broader encompassing of the oral tradition. The first, most simple part of the oral tradition is the interpretation of what's going on in the Torah. The Torah tells you, let's see, what's our first mitzvah? Pru Urvu. Okay, so that's the first mitzvah in Bereishis. How do you fulfill Pru Urvu? Does that mean have as many kids as you can? What does that mean? Multiply. Torah says, don't eat the gid hanoshe. Where is the gid hanoshe? What part of the animal am I not supposed to eat? The Torah says to circumcise. It says Abraham was uncertain. What does it mean circumcise? Cut off the tip of my nose? What is it? Torah doesn't say which organ should be circumcised. Doesn't? It says circumcise every male. It doesn't say where you circumcise him. Maybe you should cut his ear off. It doesn't say. It says cut off a piece of skin for every male. So I don't know if there's a single mitzvah that we would be able to perform. Yeah, it says a foreskin. What's called a foreskin? We're used to calling that piece of skin a foreskin, but who said that's a foreskin? Maybe the earlobe is a foreskin. It says orla, foreskin. What's orla? Literally means a skin that's covering, that's extra. Well, which skin is extra? Who said that's extra? If you want, I'll explain to you why that's not extra at all. That piece of skin, anatomically. I mean, there's a. Want me to explain? Now is not the time for it. A different time. But we are so accustomed to the oral tradition's interpretation of the Torah that when we read Orla, we automatically think, sure, that's an Orla.
Even in Tanakh, when David HaMelech cuts off all the...
That's the definition of Orla. I'm just saying, even the Talmud searches and says, how do you know that? How do you know Orla means that?
Well, we think from David HaMelech cut off their noses.
Well, no, because the word Orla really means what we call today a foreskin. But I'm just saying the word orlah doesn't have to mean that. Orlah means something covering or something extra or something stuffing up.
Nowhere in Tanakh does it refer to that organ where we do it?
Well, it says orlat bisarchem, the skin covering your flesh. What skin is it talking about? The Talmud proves it from using laws of inference, which we'll discuss in a minute. But I'm just saying there is hardly a mitzvah which we would be able to perform. Judaism, the way we know it, is based on the oral tradition. Go open a Tanakh and figure it out on your own. You're not going to get very far. You'll invent your own religion. But it won't look like Judaism at all.
So how do the Karaites live?
So the truth is that the Karaites are an evolving religion. The Karaites in different generations practice Judaism differently because everyone interprets it the way they think. And if it's up to my interpretation, so then I'll interpret it this way and you'll interpret it that way. If there is no oral tradition, and in truth, throughout the generations, up until Hitler, there were three main schools of Karaites. There were three types of Karaites. Now I'm not sure if there are remnants to two of them, to the two European, the European and Asian one. I'm not sure the one that's here. There are communities of Karaites. They're a dying breed, but they exist. So the Karaites comes from the word kra. Kra is a verse. And there are people already from the days of the Talmud who refused to accept the oral tradition. As we said, every generation had their people who said, we're not going with the oral tradition. So it's in Moshe Rabbeinu's time you had challenges to the oral tradition.
So are these like the Samaritans?
Right. Correct. So the Samaritans are an example of that. The Sadducees are an example of that. And the Karaites are an example of that. If you say so, I don't know why you say that. If you say so, deserves a broader discussion. Let's see, what I told them is a Maimonides. Maimonides says what I just said, but it doesn't matter. Let's. I didn't say either one's Jewish. I don't think he's talking about what you're talking about. But at any rate, let's continue because we're way off topic and we're very short on time. We haven't even started. So when Moshe Rabbeinu received the written Torah, with it he received Mishnah and Gemara. Mishnah and Gemara are not later inventions. Moshe had Mishnayos, which he said. The truth is Mishnayos even predated the Torah, but that deserves a separate discussion. But the simple understanding is that when Moshe received the written Torah, with it he received Mishnah, which is a shorthand version of redacting the oral tradition, and Gemara, which is the logic behind the Mishnah. So you had, from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, you had the written Torah written publicly, and then people kept shorthand notes in their closets, because really the oral tradition was not meant to be written or publicized, but people kept different types of notes, what they called Megillat Sterim, where they'd hide in their closet some kind of a recounting of the oral tradition. So far, so good?
Why were they hiding it?
Because technically the oral tradition was not permitted to be written, so they didn't want to go publicizing a written version of the oral tradition. So any notes that you had to take of the oral tradition were borderline, because really you're not supposed to write down the oral tradition. So the best you could do was, if you had to take notes, which everyone did, was they'd keep their notes in a closet. So it was a way of showing I'm not publicizing the oral tradition in written form.
I think if it was that important, they would all write it down so they'd know what to do exactly.
You can't encompass it in writing. As much as you try, you will never encompass the oral tradition in writing. There's a covenant we have that the written law must remain written. And no, if you want to learn Gemara without a tradition, you're not going to get where you have to. Yeah, you need tradition. The oral law is so broad that, yeah, you could get a very limited understanding, but the majority of it is oral. And even till today, you want to learn Gemara correctly, you have to learn by Rebbe. You're going to try learning on your own. So you have Art Scroll, and we keep trying to make it easier and easier and easier, but you're still not going to get there. I haven't yet seen anyone become a huge Talmud Chacham from Art Scroll. It's a good starting point, but you got to move from there. You got to learn by someone. The oral tradition is still a tradition. Even the Gemara is a shorthand version, and the Mishnah is an even shorter version. So we have Mishnayos and Gemaros, and we still have some of our Mishnayos date back to Moshe Rabbeinu. On a different occasion, we can prove it. Uri, we're down to 15 minutes. If it's critical, I'm with you. If we can wait, so... Okay. So, our Mishnayot and Gemarot, in a broad sense, come from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu. So, they're given a written Torah, they're given an oral tradition. Together with that, they were also given 13 laws of inference. Now, the laws of inference are laws of logic. They're a fortiori. Fortiori is a Kal Vachomer. You guys familiar with a Kal Vachomer? Yes? If Aviel is 10 times as strong as me, if I could lift this, then he could for sure lift it, okay? So that's a fortiori. So there are 13 logical laws of inference, which are also used by modern law today. Rav Pesen Zatzal wrote a book showing how all the laws of inference are also used in the interpretation of constitutional law. These are logical laws. You just have to learn how to use them. Now, they were given a very exact tradition on how to use the laws of inference. So what that means is that the Torah was given the capacity to expand in multiple ways. The first way being using the laws of inference, meaning Moshe Rabbeinu is taught the Torah and the oral tradition to a degree. Now, come future generations, they are going to use the laws of inference to derive answers to their questions. Now, when Moshe was up at Sinai, God gives him the 13 laws of inference and says, okay, Moshe, let's take a new case that's not written in the Torah. Let's practice. Here's the new case. Now let's use the laws of inference to derive the answer to that case. So God lets Moshe have a chance at it. And Moshe comes up with 49 ways of proving that this new instance should be permissible. God tells Moshe, okay, now keep working. Moshe keeps thinking logically and he says, you know, I could come up with 49 ways using the Torah of proving that it should be prohibited. So God tells Moshe, way to go. So Moshe says, what do you mean? What do I do with that if I could prove either way logically? So how do I ever reach a conclusion? So God says, what you do is convene a court. You teach the people the laws of inference, top level. And they sit there and they distill their knowledge of the laws of inference till they're pros at using the laws of inference. And then you convene a court. And when you convene the court will sit down and analyze the new cases, the top students, the top rabbis, will sit down, and when new cases come up, they will apply the laws of inference. And what will happen is, some will go one way, and others will go the other way. And then they'll have a conversation, and they'll try to convince one another. And through the discourse, you will end up with a situation where the majority of the court will find one angle more logical than the other, being that these are laws of logic. So then, they will ultimately reach different conclusions, even though they're both logical. It's not that one's right and one's wrong. And that's the idea we're in the middle of learning on Friday in our Drashot Aran classes. The Torah has the potential of going in more than one direction. But, Hashem says, the direction that is going to be defined is the direction that the High Court rules. Meaning, Hashem says, even though you can prove this way or that way, when you have the top rabbis sitting and analyzing it, then the human factor will define what the halacha is. You will go by the majority opinion, present the case to the courts, and then each of you give your opinion. From Moshe Rabbeinu onward, Moshe was the only one who was permitted to say, God said this. Moshe says in the Torah, from this day onward, you have any more questions? Use the laws of inference. Use your Torah. You're not allowed to ask God. Our tradition is that in the days of mourning over Moshe Rabbeinu, they forgot 3,000 halachos. So they turned to Joshua and said, Joshua, help us out. We can't remember. Joshua said, neither can I. So Joshua turns to God and says, God, help me out. God says, no. So Joshua says, what do you mean? So that's the first verse in the book of Joshua. God tells Yoshua, Moshe avdi mit. Moshe, my servant, died. Vata. And now your job is go fight the wars. What are the wars? Our tradition is that that pasuk is a reference to the wars of Torah. Go sit down and break your head with the courts and come to conclusions. Use the laws of derivation. I'm not telling you the answer. That those days are over. The Torah was given to Moshe. There's no more heavenly intervention as to what the conclusion is going to be. Now you got to work. So that's what Joshua does. He convenes the court and they sit down using the laws of derivation and they still can't figure it out. Because that deserves a whole broader discussion about why and how. That's maybe one day we'll have to get back to that story. So we have the laws of derivation. Now, you had to really be a master of those laws of logic. It wasn't just a question of, I got it after a day or a week or a month. It took years of learning and honing, to the point where very shortly after Moshe died, it was only a few generations later that the rabbis came to the conclusion, we're not up to par. And they took out the capacity to learn Gzeirah Shavah. Meaning the rabbis at a very early stage said, we haven't mastered that law of derivation called Gzeirah Shavah, where you say two words appear in Torah. One appears here and one appears there, and they teach me, I derive from one to the other. So that was the first to go. I don't know of any source that gives an exact date, but it might have been in between the first and second temple, meaning long before the Mishnah was written. It might have been then. I would think that that's about when. If I had to guess, so using different sources, my thought is that the Gzeirah Shavah, the latest that probably lasted was to the beginning of the second temple. That was the latest. It might have been much earlier. It might have been already in King Solomon's time that they ruled out new applications. But at some point in Jewish history, early in Jewish history, the rabbi said, we can no longer use that law unless you have a tradition. If you have a tradition going back to the days of Moshe, going back to the days when you could apply that law, then you can say Gzeirah Shavah. But you cannot invent a new one on your own. We don't buy that any rabbi has a strong enough tradition to apply that law of derivation, has a strong enough tradition on the law on its own. If you have a tradition that this is where it should be applied, these two words appear in two places, fine, use it. But if you don't have a tradition going back to Moshe, you can't invent new Gzeirah Shavah. So that was very early in Jewish history. Till today, we have one law of derivation that we're still allowed to use, and that is the law of Kal Vachomer, a fortiori. That's the last one that we have left, that any person who knows enough can use it using the laws we know. So we have the written law, we have the oral law, we have the capacity for the oral law to expand in that realm of of the 13 laws of derivation. Now what's phenomenal about that is that what the rabbis will tell you based on the laws of derivation is biblical. Meaning the laws of derivation are really laws of inference, laws of interpreting the Torah, and whatever they're going to say is pshat in the Torah becomes biblical. So let's take an example. The Torah says, I want you to tithe, I want you to give the gifts to the Kohen and Levite off of your Dagon, Tirosh, Yitzar, off of your grain, Dagon, Tirosh, wine, Yitzar, oil. So you come and say, what do I have to give Truma and Meiser from? So we say, many things. So you'll say, but the Torah gives me three. Yeah, but we have a law of logic that says that when the Torah says a general term, then gives specifics, and then a general term again, so then the Torah is telling you the specifics are examples. It's not limited to those examples. Anything that will have the same characteristics as those examples is obligated. So that becomes biblical. If I have to give Truma and Meiser from all seven species, because I say, what's unique about those three? They're from the seven species, right? Grain, wine, oil, they're from the seven species. So all seven species you have to give Truma and Meiser from biblically. So the laws of derivation are really laws with which the rabbis will expand the written Torah. They will expand the biblical Torah, the Torah. It's not a rabbinic institution, it's a Doraisa institution. You guys with me till here?
Well, it can't be Doraita if it's... It'll have to be Drabanan.
No.
I'm actually kind of...
That's that... If you use a law of inference, a law of logic, so what you're really doing is you're interpreting the Torah. And one of the strengths they were given is that interpretation becomes biblical.
I can't see how it can be Doraita. It has to be Drabanan.
Why?
Because it's a rabbi... Did a Kal Vachomer to the Dagan Tirosh and Yitzhar, and there can't be a law from God if it wasn't written exactly. I can understand it making it a Rabbanat, but the Raita seems a bit different to me.
So let's take a case in the Torah. We didn't get there yet. The Torah says, you may not marry your sister who shares a father or a mother with you. What happens if she shares both? Doesn't say in the Torah she's prohibited. What are you going to say? It's permitted. It's only rabbinic? No, you wouldn't say that.
Well, Rabbi, if
it's more obvious.
So that's a kal vachomer. That's what you're saying. It's a law of inference. You're saying it didn't say it, but it's obviously included.
It did say it, though. It said it under two conditions. You meet both criteria.
So you're right that this is a type of kal vachomer, which is encompassing. There are other types of kal vachomers, but you're right. This
or
is
a logic that doesn't work. It's an or and an and.
Yes, I mean the
or is not included.
Exactly. I mean, the
so 5 minutes ago, hold on.
He's answering you nicely.
Yeah, I understand that, but
it says if she is the daughter of your father or your mother. So that seems to say either or.
5 minutes ago, when we were talking before, you said, the current code of ethics in an army is to say, oh, is he actually coming at me or this? And you have to put, like, scientific thought into the exactness of the situation, and now you're saying you're implying that it's wrong and not the Jewish way to do things, and now we have to say or this when if something meets both, they meet both. We can make a judgment call based on one or the other. We have a choice here.
It's not what the Torah says. You're making an inferring correctly that it's a sur. But not because the Torah says.
Okay, the Torah says you should not marry your sister to the same father. If you have a sister
or
that
mother,
it says or mother. It doesn't say and.
You need the oral law.
I understand that you need the oral law. No, I'm not.
No, for that.
I'm not disputing the oral law. I'm disputing, because we're looking at the words exactly. Which that's the Jewish way to infer law or to decide law, whatever. You know, and then 15 minutes ago when we were talking about the army, we were saying that that's not the way. That's what I'm getting confused about. And I see it both ways. But either way, if it meets two criteria, why do we have to infer that it's together? Instead of just, treat two separate. If someone engages in such an action, he's guilty of the crime in two different ways. He's still guilty. What's the big deal?
Fine. So, on a different occasion, we have to dissect this example. Let's take another example. If the Torah says, don't marry your granddaughter, does that necessarily mean you can't marry your daughter?
I would say yes.
But you understand, is that biblical or rabbinic? Because the Torah says, "Ervat bat bincha o bat bitecha lo tegale ki ervatcha hina." Torah doesn't say don't marry your daughter. It says don't marry. Wait. Ah. One second. Torah says, don't marry the daughter of your son or the daughter of your daughter. What about your own daughter? So that's a fortiori. If I'm prohibited from someone who's so distant from me, then I'm obviously prohibited from someone who's close to me, but it doesn't say it. So that's one of the laws of inference, and that is biblical.
Okay.
So that's an example. I'm just giving an example. I'm saying there are many examples. The whole Talmud is these examples, but there are laws of logic. Now, we don't have them perfected, so we can't answer new questions when Ilan Ramon lands on the moon and asks us, when do I keep Shabbos? When do I say Kriya Shema? When do I do my mitzvos? When do I put on tefillin? We have a problem. We cannot go back to the Torah and say, okay, let me figure it out. We can't. We don't have that strength anymore. They haven't had that strength since the year 4000 on the Jewish calendar. That's when we lost that strength, which was approximately 4,000 on the Jewish calendar is a short time before the destruction of the Second Temple. So what happened? I didn't want to jump there yet. Let's continue with our introduction and we'll get there, Bezalel Shem. What happened at that period? So we said one aspect of the oral law is the laws of inference, which is really things that are biblical, as we explained earlier. Things that are derived from the laws of inference have biblical weight. There's another thing called halacha al-Moshe mi-Sinai, things that we have on tradition from Moshe that have no source in the Torah. Your tefillin being black doesn't say anywhere. The straps being black, maybe they should be gold, doesn't say anywhere. So there are, what?
Even what the tefillin are doesn't say anywhere.
So that, okay. So that's part of the oral tradition. But halacha Moshe Misinai, that you tie them in a square shape. If you look at the string that ties your tefillin closed, it's tied in the shape of a square. That's halacha Moshe Misinai. So we have many parts of Judaism that stem from a halacha Moshe Misinai, tradition from Moshe from Sinai. They have no written basis, but they are halacha Moshe Misinai. So far we've explored two aspects of the oral tradition, the 13 laws of derivation, and halacha Moshe Misinai. There are going to be more, but we're out of time for tonight.